Welcome. This is the Nuclear Community Archives panel around the globe. I'm really excited to chair this. My name's E.G. Crichton. I'm an artist, and I work with archives, and I have collaborated with the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco. And we have four really wonderful panelists, but I also need to announce first two reminders. One is the group photo session for this whole conference. And I found out where it's going to be. You have to go up to the food level, the dinner level, but around to the front facing the pond or whatever it is. I think they really want people to be up there right after this panel at 5:30. So, and then the final concluding session is at 7, and that's in the main theater. So I'm going to introduce each person as they go up so that you don't forget who they are. And the first person I want to introduce is, I'm going to butcher his name, but Andre Mirachis. Andre studied scenography at the Theater and Cinema Superior School and completed Master of Arts in Scenography at the Hodges School voor de Kunsten in Utrecht, the Netherlands. He is a writer, director, and performer of several theater pieces, and he also wrote and directed the first Portuguese gay web series focused on the local bear community called Rough Beard, and created Queer Kivo, the first Portuguese LGBT archive. Andre.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming, and thank you for these 3 days. It's been really inspiring. So I'll try to use this. Queer Kivo is a Portuguese LGBT archive. There are no LGBT archives in my country, nothing printed. There is a small online project with 2-3 interviews. We have ILGA Portugal as an archive of newspapers, but there's nothing bigger than this. And I thought to myself, where are the people's stories? Where are they? I always liked gay history. I wanted to know more, and I wanted to know more about the LGBT history in my country. In Portugal, when we speak about gay icons, people in the past, we have always two names that we mention, and most of them are people who died related with AIDS. So I thought there must be more than this. Let me give you a little context just to help you understand this lack of archiving LGBT country in my country. In the 1920s, Lisbon had a modernist life in the heart of the city with cabarets and nightlife, as you can see. But then we had a dictatorship from 1923 until 1974. So it's about 40 years, which is a lot. And we are still recovering from this. And this affects visibility, affects memory. There's no visibility, memory fades. And when memory is lost, the archiving is also lost. When I was putting together the idea of creating something that could be a tribute to these people, I had just seen a play, an English play called The Inheritance. It's a magnificent play. If you can see it, it's now reviving in Broadway. And they talk a lot about these questions of what to do with memories, with this inheritance that history gives us. And so, as the character in the play says, I started a conversation with the past. I wanted to create an archive, not in a Wikipedia style, so I asked a group of people to write about their icons, people who inspired them on becoming better queer people, better citizens. I also had an open call and made some direct invitations to different personalities. I built a site, and every week, there was a text from an author about someone. There were no filters, no censorship, just a group of very different voices. Together with this, there were some illustrations that I also draw. And later on came a book. These are my illustrations of our queer people. The book has the texts in Portuguese that were published online, and it also has an English translation text of it. And thus we have created what I called an emotional archive. I would like to present you now with some of the tributes that have been written to this project, and to present you these personalities that are part of Queer Keep. I will start with Lila Fadista in the music area. Lila Fadista is a singer from a Portuguese music project which is called Fado Bicha. Fado is a Portuguese kind of music, and Bicha means a queer faggot. So they assume they own the name, and it's one of the most incredible things that was created in my country in the last years. And she, Lila, wrote about Amália, which is our Fado Diva, and she speaks about how all the songs of Fado that are sung by Amália helped her, because they are very suffering songs, and how it helped her in her childhood to pass through this her suffering. Then in the visual area, in the visual arts area, we have a visual artist called Ana Pérez Gonçalves, Quiroga, I'm sorry. She wrote about a lesbian sculptor from the 20s that it's called Ana de Gota Colas. Ana was a lesbian. She was one of the first women to wear the men's pants in the 20s and the garçon hair. And so this Ana writes about how the other Ana inspired her as a lesbian and as an artist. Then in the literature field, we have one writer that has two texts from two different writings. His name is António Boto, and he was a poet from the 20s who died penniless. He was married to a woman and lived in exile after a big scandal where his books were burned by the beginning of the dictatorship in the end of the 20s. Ana Cabocla is just released an official biography on him, which is very interesting, only in Portuguese, I'm sorry. And João wrote, he's a fan, he's a reader, he's a common citizen if you want, and he wrote about how his poetry, which is one of the first homoeroticist poets that we have, how it helped him also through his life to find something else in the text. Then we have also in the music area, we have a text on a gay singer called António Variações. He is a pop singer from the 80s, who was also one of our first ones to die from AIDS. And it was the first time this word was published on a newspaper associated with someone on the public eyes in the 80s. So it was quite a scandal, so to say. And the guy on your left is a lawyer, and he wrote about how he used to mock and how ashamed he is now of mocking António when he was a kid, because all the other kids mocked him because he was gay. He was quite extravagant to the 80s. It has a kind of fado tone in his voice, but also very modern. What he was doing in the 80s, no one else was doing, so this is quite new and fresh, and it's a pity that it disappeared so soon. They're making a movie about him, and it's about to open. I already seen it. I believe it's going to go through the festival market, so if you can have a look at it, remember his name, because it's going to be really an experience. Then we have Frederico Lourenço, which is a poet and a Latin translator, and is a novelist also. And he has a text by Miguel March, who is a lawyer and a radio host and a fan of him. Frederico has three novels that became really mainstream. And the novels are about a romance between a professor and a student. And as a young man, Miguel read them and discovered that gay life was just not just clubs or just drugs, as we see a lot, but it could also be very romantic and very loving. Then we have a text on Gisberta, which was a Brazilian transsexual. And she has a text that was written by Bruno Maia, who is a nurse. And Gisberta was murdered by a group of kids. During 1 week, they had tied her up, they beaten her, they did everything to her. And this was the first time a hate crime, and the word hate crime, came to the Portuguese newspapers. It was also very polemic because the kids were from a social institution, so there were also responsibilities to that institution. And the text of Bruno Maia, he used to be one of those kids, he used to live in one of those institutions, so he reflects about the paper of education in those places. Then we have a text by a writer called Luis Schwarz about a comedian called Hermann José. He's also a German one. Hermann is German, is the Deutsch. And he lived in Portugal for a lot. He used to be a very well-known comedian in the 80s. And now there are a lot of comedians in my country. But in the 80s, he was the only one that used gender and queerness to make fun of people. And seeing this on television in the 80s was everything, because it was our escape. And it was done with lots of humor and lots of fun. So people accepted in a different way. Then we have the social VIP. I didn't know how to catalog him. I'm sorry. Sometimes it's hard to deal with labels. His name is José Castelo Branco. And he has a text by a fan called Gonçalo Cota. José Castelo Branco is married to a woman. It is said that she's one of our first transsexuals, but it's not discussed. He has a son. They say it's adopted. He's fun, he's camp, he's very exaggerated. He's the queen of Instagram in Portugal. He's applying for politics now, which I think is the best of it. And he has no shame at all. And the text of Gonçalo Costa talks about that. So he's different, and I like him, and it's fun to have someone who just doesn't care what people think. Then we have a text by a movie director about a movie director from the 20s who was straight and who was also a reporter. But in his movies, in the 20s, before dictatorship, this was the first time that we saw gay characters and gay representation, a lot of it. We had transvestites, we had the CC, and most of these films disappeared. There are only two remaining films, which is absolute pity. Mm-hmm. In the drag universe, we have a text about drag and transsexual Utbriden that were written by a young writer called Inês. And she writes about how Ruth was a very well-known figure in the 80s and in the 90s, in the drag nightclubs. She was known by her bad temper. Everybody knew her because of that. Sorry. And she has a very tragic life. She used to live with a man who had an addiction problem. And she was transitioning also, and her boyfriend had a lot of problems with this transition, besides drug issues. And but the boyfriend didn't accept, but she stayed with him until his last days. She took care of him. He died of an overdose, and she died the next day. And when she went to a burial, she left a note saying that she wanted to be buried in men's clothes, because she lived her whole life as a woman. She wanted to die like a man. And they also made a movie about it, inspired on her life. It's called To Die Like a Man. It's made by a Portuguese queer director, you might know him, João Pedro Rodrigues. He has a movie called Phantom, which is very shocking, so to say, in my country, and he is very well known outside our country. You can also have a look because I'm on it as an editor. So it's a short, but it's a good one. Anyway, going back to the music field, we also have a text by Simone Telge, who is a drag queen known as Simone La Dragma. And he made a text about our Eurovision queen, Simone de Oliveira. And she's also a gay icon, of course. And he writes about how the strength of this woman who survived cancer, domestic violence, the death of a child, inspired him to be a drag queen who uses part of his name. They're both called Simone. And the most beautiful thing is, last year, they met, so it was a dream of his. That's him singing his songs in costume, and that's her. Really nice.
1 minute.
Oh, sorry, already. Remember his name? Valentin de Barge is a dancer who stayed in a hospital after a lobotomy after 40 years. Okay, I don't have time. But you can search for him later on. I need to conclude that the major conclusion that I can make is that people can write about their icons in a very emotional way, and I think that's the biggest conclusion that I reach with this project. You can find this and other stories in the website or in the book. I have some copies to give you, not much, but if you can talk with me at the end, I'll be happy to give them to you. I also recognize that this is 10% of the stories that we have in my country, that is just the beginning of something that needs to be done. My country is covered with fog, as we say, our history is covered with fog. Because our first king was a gay one of our first kings. He was called Sebastian. And they say he went to a battle one day on a foggy day and disappeared. So we are always hoping that he will come back on a foggy day. So meanwhile, while we are waiting for him, I think we should tell their stories and we should say their names. Thank you.
Thank you, Andre. That was wonderful. I got a note that gives me a correction on the photo information. The photo of everybody at the conference is going to be at 6:30 upstairs facing the pond, so after dinner. And then the second announcement they wanted me to make is if you don't want to keep your conference program booklet or the lanyard that we got, please return them to the information desk. So now I want to introduce our second speaker. Hang on. Meg Tamulanis. And Meg has been a volunteer with the Vermont Pride Center for 20 years, beginning with caring for the VQA, as it's called, in her home. And the VQA is now housed at the
Pride Center.
Pride Center, Vermont, where she has served as co-chair of the board and as a volunteer. Meg is now completing an MA in history at the University of Vermont and is also co-curator of a traveling exhibition on Alison Bechtel, 2018, and is the manager of collections and exhibitions at the University of Vermont.
Thank you.
Welcome.
I hope it's okay if I sit here to talk. Can you all hear me okay? Or do you stand?
No.
Because otherwise it'd be all trembly and stuff. I work behind the scenes at the museum where I'm at. I'm not used to sitting at table. Anyway, thank you all very much for being here. And thank you so much for moderating this discussion. And I really appreciate my fellow panelists as well. But really, all of the discussions and conversations and presentations I've heard over the past few days have been freaking amazing. And I'm so humbled to be a part of it. The archive, just as a note, the archive I work with is pretty small compared to lots of the others that we've been hearing about, and it's new in some ways and kind of old in others. It's been around for 20 years, but it's been so slow in development. There have been very few people working on it because it's all volunteer, that I feel like we've gotten only as far as maybe a larger archive with staff would have gotten in a year or two. But we've had some progress, and that's what I'm going to be talking about a little bit at this. The Vermont Career Archives was begun with the founding of a local community center in Burlington, Vermont in 1998. It's been housed variously in literally in a closet, in an office space, at a community center, and in two different private homes as it moved around a little bit. 20 years later, it now consists of 25 boxes of ephemera, newspapers, and artifacts, including banners, t-shirts, water bottles, etc. Let me see if I can get this moving through just so you can kind of see some of the examples. The VQA reflects just a part of the history of the LGBT experience in Vermont. We certainly can't claim to be very broad, and we're working on becoming more comprehensive. An inventory, multiple exhibitions, and projects with local artists have kept it as an active, if not always fully accessible, project. As the Pride Center of Vermont now celebrates its 20th anniversary and grows and develops more ambitious programming, and as the Vermont LGBTQ community changes, interest in the queer archives has begun to increase. So I've been working with the archive for 20 years, and it's been interesting to sort of see those different ups and downs. So I'll be interested to see what happens over the next few years. There have, especially in the past couple of years, and I'll talk a little bit about it, there have been some really interesting conversations and discussions around this topic. I also wanted to note, for a few reasons, this paper is also a very personal story. As I said, I became involved with the archives 20 years ago through the RU12 Community Center. I have one of the old t-shirts, not from the archive, this is my from a personal archive, that then became the Pride Center of Vermont. When I relocated to Vermont with my then partner in 1999, we were literally walking down the main drag on Church Street in Burlington and came across a bunch of cool queer people selling cupcakes, and they were planning to found a Pride Center. Like, this is home right here. So some of them are some of my closest friends. One of them is now the director of the Pride Center. It's just been such an important part of my own personal life, the center themselves. The Pride Center of Vermont grew from a class project at the University of Vermont in 1997. A small group of college students and very recent college graduates developed the idea and very uniquely and from the very beginning included a queer archive as what was going to be part of the center. According to some of the participants, I've done oral histories with them now, they did not want to be perceived as young upstarts who didn't understand the past. So they just wanted to immediately have an archive as part of the center. Interestingly, they chose to call it the Vermont Queer Archive from the very beginning, which then nettles some of the older people in the community, and that's been a conversation we've been having for decades, but we've stuck with the name, and it continues to work at this time. There was also a sense of the need to document the origins of the center and the various communities who were involved. So there was this more conscious kind of at least minimal collecting. The founders had also learned about the outreach and impact of the Lesbian Herstory Archives. And as I said, the hope was to really show that they were respecting the elders in the community. One of the very first installations that the Queer Archives did was at the first annual community dinner. We had our 20th in May. Was of materials gathered from and for the archives, all reflecting the various LGBT organizations that were present in Burlington and the Vermont area at the time. And the archives now hold those old kind of bowing sheets of poster board with Xeroxes glued to them as part of the collection. It's also important to note, I think, that institutionalized archives, such as those at the State Historical Society and the University of Vermont, and I work for the University of Vermont, were not actively or visibly collecting LGBTQ history in Vermont. There was no outreach on their part to the queer community in Vermont at all, and this has definitely changed, but it's taken two decades for that to happen. The archives were gathered in a plastic tub and kept in a community center founder's apartment. They consisted of brochures and mailings from a variety of the local queer organizations, some of the very first flyers produced by the RU12 Community Center, and newspapers and issues of a local newsletter donated early on to the archives. So we have a full run of a lesbian newspaper called Common Woman. This actually has proven to be one of the most utilized and exhibitable portions of the collection, as we've installed small exhibitions at the center and at local libraries and some other venues, and the photographs and quotations from printed local publications have been really, really helpful. For me, after a few months of attending potlucks and other social programs, I volunteered for the Queer Archives. These were run by this one recent college graduate with that plastic tub in her apartment. And after one meeting with a cup of coffee, she showed up at my apartment the next day with a tub and was like, "You're in charge of these now." So that was 20 years ago. I started in the guest room initially. I feel sort of embarrassed to tell you about this. It was under a bed for a while. But the archives did continue to grow, right? Because people heard about them, they wanted to contribute things to them. Anyone with anything that might be of interest to the archives was directed to me, and I found myself speaking with a variety of community members, from politicians to activists to students doing research on the LGBT community. We also formed an archives committee where I hoped to gain some volunteers and have some help and responses to inquiries, and that kind of ebbed and flowed. We were able to set up a separate email on the center website. That was really helpful, so I just could know, you know, if I was going to spend an archives hour, I could just check that email and see what had come in. We developed a mission statement and a collecting plan, and at that point we were really reactive in our collecting. It was sort of just like emergency situations where we'd take in material and then we would do a sweep of ephemera and material from every Pride celebration in Burlington, which was the main place for Pride at that point. That's also changed. When the community center found its first true office space, we used to have meetings in a local nonprofit, and then we found an actual space. We were able to create a display on the Queer Archives, and we ended up doing a history of Pride celebrations in Vermont using some of those newspapers. And at the time, there was still microfilm at the library, so we printed out from microfilm, et cetera, and we were able to do a bit of a timeline. Including the covers of the common woman that I mentioned and personal photographs that people had brought in too of Pride celebrations from the 80s onward. It also included quotations from oral histories that I had worked on with a Pride organizer from that year's Pride committee, where we reached out to people asking about the founding of Pride, and that was another great way to sort of meet up with people who were still in the community and had been involved with Pride since the 80s, and a great way to honor them too. A few things were especially striking to us from that: how willing and generous the interviewees were. They were so kind to meet up with us, and I'm sure some of our questions seemed really silly to them, but they're really helpful. How they were very, also would have liked to have given their archival materials pretty quickly to us, and we took some of them. We didn't take all because we did not have the space. And also how no two accounts of the founding of the first Pride fully agreed. That was a lesson to me. My history is 18th and 19th century history, so I didn't have to talk to people who actually lived through the thing. People from 1983 had a lot of opinions, and not everybody agreed. Anyway, but the passion and sheer interestingness of the people I was talking to and the history of the community that I was becoming a part of got me totally hooked on continuing work on the archives. Within the first few years, the Queer Archives received a grant from a local LGBT foundation, which provided our first truly archival storage material, including the Hollinger boxes and other familiar items, I'm sure. And that was actually the first formal grant to what was then the RU12 Community Center, so that was very exciting. Shortly afterwards, we did an exhibition at the local library in Burlington, and we've done several since then. So every few years, we'll do an exhibition. Those exhibitions are held in public gallery spaces. It's a chance to have a public reception, have people attend, kind of look at things, talk about them. Really, it's a chance to have a celebration. We also set up programs, usually roundtable discussions, panel discussions, or just tours. So it's a great way to do outreach to the general community, as well as the queer community. It's really good outreach for the center. And in those displays, we've displayed items including an early gay pride banner, a painting by a local drag queen artist, pamphlets from queer organizations in the 1970s and 80s, and even civil union invitations. Just so you can get a sense of some of the items in the archives, including artifacts like that water bottle. The Vermont Queer Archives have steadily and slowly expanded over the years. And for a few years, they were stored entirely in my apartment and then a house. And during that time, as I said, we added to them pretty reactively. A set of local queer magazines might be left at the community center with a note for the archives or a random box of stuff. I really liked hearing about the random boxes of stuff that other archives are dealing with because it was a real relief to me personally. A professor cleaning out his garage would call me when he came across a forgotten cache of posters advertising gay dances in the 1970s. That was just amazing. And then they've been added to the archives. All of these items that really did seem like they would otherwise be lost unless we were able to take them in. Then an intern at the community center suggested an artist project called the Dialogue Project, and I'm going to actually sort of skim through this because I only have a few minutes, but where she set up interviews with elders in the community after speaking with youth in the community, asking them what kind of questions they wanted to ask elders, and then did oral histories. We did work with the Vermont Folklife Center, and then shared those oral histories with artists from the general community, who then produced artwork related to those oral histories. So they produced everything from collage to paintings to songs. And that project traveled throughout the state of Vermont. And when it opened in Burlington, we had some of the singers who'd written songs from the archives, et cetera. And even one of them still performs today. And she still sings that song. And I'm just about a young man coming out in the 60s. So I just, you know, it's wonderful how the art can persist as well. And it's in the archives as well. And this was this project connected, as I said, the community center and the queer archives to the Vermont Folklife Center in Middlebury, Vermont. And that was a really fruitful project for us. And then we reversed the project where we interviewed elders and asked them what questions they had for youth. I know they all could have sat down together too, and we did have that at some of the receptions, but it was just a way to have more formal recorded interviews, and then interviewed youth, and then a set of artists produced artwork around that. So it came in two sets. And that's a few years ago, so we're considering doing it again. I can almost say with relief that those displays only resulted in a few small donations to the archives, and we still do get them left at the door. But then in 2009, the community center moved from Burlington to Winooski, and we lost even the teeny bit of storage space that was at the community center space there. So the archives came back to my house. I'm like really closing up this really fast, sorry. But then, after several years, the center found another space in Burlington, and I had to sit down with the director and say, these can't be in my home anymore. I'm like, I love having them here. In a way, I'll tell you, the day that they did leave my house felt kind of bittersweet to me, but at that point, it was like 20 boxes from my living room, and I was about to do a construction project. They just had to go, and they ended up getting stored in a loft space in the community center, here's one of the gay dance posters, which is somewhat it's accessible, but you need a ladder to get up there. The next cool thing that happened, though, was that in the center, they just bought, in the past year, two storage cabinets for the archives that are lockable. They're stored in the coffee break room, so that's not ideal, but it's actually a safer place for the archives. There's a loft space, and the former director of the Pride Center, he's only former because he retired, not because he fell out of loft, but he's about to hand me the boxes there. Another major thing that we were able to do this past year was we were approached by the University of Vermont Library, and yes, I work in the museum, and I have colleagues in the library, so I know that was part of the reason, to digitize Out in the Mountains, which was the gay newspaper in Vermont in the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s. But when the organization that published Out in the Mountains dissolved, they handed over all of their legal material to the Pride Center. So the Pride Center formerly owned Out in the Mountains, and we were able to make an arrangement with the library for them to digitize the full set. And now it's pretty searchable. So going back from the days when I was first researching early Prides and going through old hard copies of Out in the Mountains, it feels so luxurious to go into the University of Vermont website and pull things up now. And there's great ways to do searches. Last year, the Pride Center and the Center for Research in Vermont and UVM did a roundtable discussion where we invited people from all over the state to have a conversation with us about the documentation and archiving of queer history in Vermont. And we had 25 people attend, and it was a great conversation. It's going to hopefully lead to more grants and outreach to other queer organizations in Vermont. And I hope that we keep on growing.
Our third person I want to introduce, Zihan Liu. Where are you? Oh, you're right there, okay. who is an artist and an academic from Singapore working at the intersections of critical theory, performance, and the moving image. He received his MFA, Master of Fine Arts, in studio practice from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and a master's in performance studies from New York University's Tisch School of the Arts. He was awarded the Young Artist Award in 2015 and an Arts Postgraduate Scholarship in 2017 by the National Arts Council of Singapore. He will be starting his PhD in my neck of the woods in performance studies at UC Berkeley in the fall.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you. I'm going to be presenting this way.
So
if you'd like to move over to those seats, that'd be fantastic. I'm also a little bit nervous, so I'll be sitting, I'll be reading from the script, and I'm trying to keep to time. 15 minutes, very tight. This might sound like a really obvious question, but how many of you are familiar with the Singaporean context? Or just a show of hands? Okay. So if at any point in time, if you have any clarifications that you'd like me to stop and perhaps clarify for you regarding terminology or context, please just let me know. Okay. Okay, let's begin. There are several refrains that one will associate with Singapore in common circulation, like Disneyland with the death penalty, corporal punishment in the form of caning, and most famously or infamously, Section 377A of the Penal Code, inherited from the British, that criminalizes private acts of consensual sex between men, and it's still in place. It appears to be a nation-state mapped out meticulously by a close reader of Foucault's governmentality, pushing the limits of biopolitics to its logical extreme. I would like to question if repression in Singapore is truly an established historical fact or one that is introduced by a colonial authority and sustained by the post-independence government as a means of control. I will address these unknowns through a querying of temporalities and sensibilities and ask, how do we resurrect queer bodies from the dust that remains? I will share a series of artworks from 2015 till 2019, and these are my attempts to adopt an archival artistic praxis. And I offer these proposals as potential strategies to rethink how we approach archives, verisimilitude, language, and storytelling. I argue that it is through the exhausting of material, both fictional and factual, virtual and actual, that we are able to engage with the thingliness of the archival remains. This thingliness is what Fred Moulton refers to, citing Heidegger, that as claims to be that which prompts the making of the object. In other words, thingliness underscores the social conditions that makes an object commodity available to some, yet impossible to others. By recalibrating our attention and definition of how we examine these archival objects, I'm reminding us to inspect the shifting shadows they cast over time and consider the narratives that they might occlude in their very presence. Okay. Hopefully it will make sense as I go into the objects themselves. So in 2015, I spent 3 months in Melbourne on an artist residency and visited the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives. I was particularly drawn to the collection of objects in Elgar's collections, also known as Realia, right?
Realia.
Yeah. It was interesting to note the variety of these materials that range from the spectacular to the everyday that queer identities were associated with and defined by. I ended up creating an installation during my residency that included photo documentation of some of these objects. This is my favorite object from the Elgar collection.
What's it from, the what?
From the main pool.
Anybody wants to guess? So Ken's on Kensington is also known as Ken's Karate Club. Was a sauna in Sydney, a gay sauna in Sydney. And on their closing night, somebody went in with a bottle and scooped a bottle of the water from the main swimming pool and sealed it and donated it somehow or through an auction. If Nick is the archivist here, so he would know the full story if you'd like to ask him. And they somehow procured it, and it belongs to Elgar now. And this is fascinating. This is a strange queer object that is within their collection. So after encountering all these objects, I returned to Singapore, and I started considering what a queer archive might look like in Singapore.
given the political situation and the context, what objects will a queer Singaporean archive hold? This was when I was approached by a curator who was putting together a queer-themed exhibition, and I decided to use the opportunity to collect material witnesses to queer life in Singapore. I sent out an open call on Facebook, and the response was rather enthusiastic within my circle and my network of affinities. This installation was designed as a temporary archive on loan, so these borrowed possessions were returned after the exhibition concluded. I assembled a collection of 81 objects from approximately 60 contributors. These objects were displayed in the exhibition space on stacked archival shelving units without individual attribution or context. This was a deliberate choice to protect the identities of those who are out in varying degrees within their social circles, and also to allow for a gap of information, creative imagination, you know, for the viewer to imagine how these objects can be radically queer. Yeah. One day before the exhibition opened, the institution flagged three objects that had the potential to be construed as quote-unquote obscene. This was performed as a preemptive measure to avoid potential legal repercussions in response to Section 2928 of the Penal Code that prohibits the public display of materials with the potential to, quote, deprave and corrupt, unquote, young minds. I was called in for a meeting with the director of the institution, and after lengthy negotiations, two objects, namely a puppy tail and a dildo, were withdrawn from the display and replaced with a vinyl shadow of their absence. When I provided an account of this third object, the glass dilator, the institution recalibrated their initial misinterpretation of it as a sex object and started to understand it as a medical device, and it was reinstated into the exhibition space. The object contributor Sandhya was candid in explaining how this dilator was part of a larger set of dilators in various dimensions that was passed down through her chosen family of sisters. Through this act of removal and reintroduction, this glass dilator was made twice invisible, as media and public attention was focused on the two objects that were censored. What was initially classified as a sex object was rendered visible only because it passed as a medical device, and in its transparency, the dilator and its narrative were obfuscated in a different manner, where it was placed off scene and no longer visible. So this gesture of violence that the institution enacted on these queer objects reproduces the disciplinary gestures enacted on queer bodies by the state. Gay sex remains illegal, but sharply in public focus, while the fungibility of a trans object subjecthood is one that is insistently defined as biological and medical, correctional instead of queer, a prosthetic of pain instead of pleasure. Another casualty of this exhibition was the relational aspect of this installation. The initial intention was for the assemblage to be constantly shifting throughout the three-month exhibition period in a bid to resist the ossification of an institutional archive. The total number of objects will be maintained at 81 throughout the duration of the exhibition, but the initial set of objects will be replaced with contributions from visitors to the gallery. So if you come into the gallery space, you can bring your idea of what a queer object might be, and you can donate it temporarily to this archive and replace some of these objects until the entire assemblage is renewed. Unfortunately, due to the censorship incident and the breakdown of communication with the institution, and the breakdown of trust, basically, this aspect of the installation was left unfulfilled. There was also a premise that I drafted to bracket this particular installation that I would like to read for you below. This hypothetical premise was included as part of the description for this installation. And here it goes. The year is 2065. The nation is celebrating SG100. Section 377A of the Penal Code has been repealed. The first transgender member of parliament was elected to represent the Aljunied constituency in the last general elections. the Ministry of Human Rights and the Community Archive are organizing an exhibition of objects from a time capsule buried 25 years ago. And this is a selection of 81 objects from that time capsule. During and after this project, I was reflecting on the potential of speculation, imagining the what ifs instead of the what had happened, transmuting the what could be into the what will be. I was also deeply dissatisfied and aware of enacting the nationalistic, patriarchal tendencies of reproducing an archon, the house of a father. How does one begin to envision an anarchic archive through an act of radical speculation? This speculative space offers up a productive opportunity to transcend what might be unbearable in this present moment. In an attempt to locate a reparative relationship with this incident, I turn to Elizabeth Freeman's conceptualization of ways to engage with history and think through strategies of archiving and reenactment differently. Freeman's erotohistoriography presumes the present as hybrid in our encounter with objects from the past, accounting for particular bodily dispositions that are triggered through archival material and objects. This notion of the present as always a hybrid of various multiple temporalities complements the condition of anachronistic instability that I adopted as I grapple with the thingliness of these objects. So in January 2019, earlier this year, I did a performance titled Catamite. This was a two-hour experience in the structure of a lesson for 20 participants. Participants were guided through a series of introspective writing exercises that interrogated their personal effects. So for example, I got everybody to lay out their objects that they brought, and then they would choose one object that might represent their existence and contribute and create a temporary archive of material objects that will represent us as a collective. Usually, if I have more time in the presentation, I will do that, but you can imagine. Yeah? They were also given the information on my critical reflection to the queer objects installation. In the second half of the experience, we turned our attention to a wristwatch that was one of the 81 objects I collected back in 2015. I shared the watch owner's, Casey's, account of this object and his rationale for contributing it to the installation. In Casey's narrative, this watch is a symbol of kinship between his father and him, and this intimacy is echoed in the relationship he then goes on to share with his long-term partner. It represents an object that was lost and later found again and renewed. I then proceed to speculate a duplicitous narrative for this watch as a strategy of gravitating towards things that are often placed out of reach of queer bodies and across different temporalities. I'm going to pass this watch around so you can take a look at it. I urge the participants, as I do to you today, to begin again, to remember to forget, to turn back time, and to reset our engagement with these objects we study. This watch became a substitute for another watch that was performing as legal actor and material witness in a court case in 1941 between a British officer and a young Malay prostitute in pre-World War II's colonial Singapore. In brief, this was one of the first few high-profile cases where both men were charged under Section 377A that was introduced just a couple of years ago before this case in 1938 to criminalize not just public but also private acts of gross indecency between men. Captain Ma, the British officer, refused to give the prostitute Sudin a reasonable sum for the remuneration of his time, and in retaliation, Sudin stole a watch from Captain Ma's residence and was subsequently arrested for this theft. Through a reconstruction of the trial transcripts documented in the newspaper archives, the participants of Catamite were able to reenact the trial and dramatize the interrogation and verdict of the court. The presiding judge pronounced the captain innocent and Sudin guilty of this same act of gross indecency. You all get the legal paradox here? If gross indecency requires two men to have sex, why is the British officer innocent and this male prostitute guilty? So we reflected on this legal paradox in the shadow of this notion of legal orientalism. I'm not sure if you are familiar with it. It's just basically certain laws that were shaped in colonial past that were determined to introduce a sense of civilized citizen to a country. that is highly racist and highly orientalist in a way. It was also tinted with the fear of impending war, espionage, and the potential of blackmail. So in the colonial conscience, Sudan was in possession of a thing that he could not have possessed, out of his material reach, and this in itself was evidence for criminality. This was an object Sudan pawned after 2 days for a quarter of its purchase price, and this transaction was one that eventually earned him 18 months of rigorous imprisonment and 2 years of police supervision. To conclude my presentation, I have shared how this, the placing of speculative frames on material objects can be a productive strategy to fill in the queer histories that were never recorded or even actively neglected, to highlight injustices like the trial between the British officer and a Ketamite in Singapore. This frame also helps us imagine possible futures and visualize one that is different from our pragmatic present, like the imaginary time capsule of queer objects. As political theorist Jane Bennett argues, is through attending to the vibrancy of things that we can raise the volume of vitality or materiality and give voice to this curious ability of inanimate things to animate, to act, to produce effects dramatic and subtle. It is through the interrogation of these effects that one is able to step back from the absorptive capacity of everyday life to consider the otherwise virtual actual things and expand their potential within our material archives. Do you all follow the last one?
Yeah.
I apologize for the sound of my timer. I didn't mean that to happen. It's rude. Last but not least, I'd like to introduce Yael. Raza, who is the founder and curator of the Visual Archive as part of the Feminist and Lesbian Archives at the Isha Center in Haifa, Israel. She is research associate at the HFA, as it's also called. Her research focuses on visual and artistic cultural representations of the LGBTQ plus community in Israel. Yael has taught interdisciplinary courses centered on queer art at the Bezalel Academy of Arts and Design.
It's okay.
And is also project entrepreneur of Artik, Queer Art in Israel, a new initiative promoting the establishment of a queer art center which will curate, present, and preserve LGBTQ art and culture in Israel.
Hi, everybody. And the last one, you'll have to be together with me, okay? I have a long breath because I apologize, my lecture is a bit theoretical, but I have a lot of pictures, so it will be easier. So it will be nice. Okay, so 4 years ago, I joined the Haifa Feminist Institute in Israel and founded the visual cultural section of the newly established Queer Archive. Since the archive is unaffiliated, autonomous, and feminist, its resources are unlimited. Therefore, our only option was to curate the items for the visual culture section solely in digital format. And I show you some of our stuff we have. We curate pictures, shirts, graffiti, some of our member community which passed away, and this, I try to translate everything so you have the idea a little bit of what we are doing. The documentation, preservation, and distribution of queer life are perceived as acts of resistance and assimilation. Subversion and confrontation of the heteronormative mainstream culture. As indicated by Derrida, an archive is nothing but a neutral place in which we store documents or objects. Archive as means to construct a collective memory and define the community's boundaries. Derrida further reminds us of the folded ambiguity essential to the archive, its desire to remember. It is the same desire which constitutes its persistent advances toward vagueness, as it expropriates the subject's memory and relocates them in the so-called anonymous safe place of the allegedly objective institute. deposit our cultural documents and artifacts in an external locus guarantees the ability to go back down the lane, recollect memories, and thereby rewrite and enhance the narrative. This option may be relevant to the hegemonic heteronormative institute, and it's required for the formal, current, unified narrative, but it is less relevant to the queer archive, to my opinion. While setting up the queer archive, we thought another option for constructing and constructing archivism. The model we ultimately choose challenges our position as passive objects of archivism. It involves the subject, the reader, or the viewer in establishing the object, what we see, read, or learn, as well as in the process of understanding the archive contribution in establishing a community. Generally speaking, the archive strives to challenge the validity of hegemonic tradition and to undermine predetermined meanings, allowing experimentation, at times even error. It is a moral demand to acknowledge the archive's items as active elements in the present and as a component that will shape the future, rather than as a mere traces of the past. In meeting this demand, sharing is the main practice adopted by the queer archive. We do not own the items in the archive. They are deposited in the name of the community for the community. There is no hierarchical. Thank you. Distinction between high, low, popular art or artifact assembled in its folders. And it welcomes questions about its structure and its ability to unveil and reestablish itself over and over again. Let me stress, the political action of founding the queer archive is not intended to protect minority rights. The kind of statement would be bind us within the binary dialects of what is worthy of preservation and what is unworthy. Our action seeks to generate continuous movement towards subversion and appropriating rather than paying homage to the hegemonic discourse. Today I would like to share some thought with you regarding the queer visual archivism as manifested in our queer digital archive through Dawn Eider's post-phenomenological lenses. While classical phenomenology, While classical phenomenology seeks to analyze our experience of the world systematically, post-phenomenology goes one step further, realizing that today fewer aspects of the world remain unmediated by some kind of technology. It stresses the multiplicity of the relations we develop with technologies surrounding us and the various ways in which this technology mediates the world for us. The first type of relation is embodiment relations, in which we experience a given technology as part of our body scheme. When I put on my glasses, I experience the world as my body and the glasses were a single unit. The post-phenomenological scheme looks like this. The parentheses indicate the temporal unity of I and technology, which has a diversified point of view and moves differently in the world from the single eye. For once, I won't bump into the door when I'll get out, or I'll be much better parking my car. Of course, me and the car become a unit. The second type is hermeneutic relations, in which I experience the world and technology as a single unit. Think of a clock or a seismograph. We must refer to the text it displays, whether the data are present in analog or digital format. The technological mediation enables us to see, learn, explore, and experience the world out there. The post-phenomenological represent the relations as in the following scheme. And the next one, the third one, is alternative relations, in which technology experienced as a quasi-object or even quasi-others. In this case, the scheme is I, technology, and the world is in the parentheses. In this type of relation, the world withdraws to the background and we focus on the relation with technology itself. As an example would be the personal assistant such as Siri or Alexa, designed to maintain authority relation with their users. The fourth type of post-phenomenological relations is the background relations. In any given moment, there are countless technologies that operate in the background, unnoticed, like the air condition we don't have, or lights in the room, and this is this him. As we may discern from these examples, all of these relations can exist simultaneously. The existence of one does not exclude the others. In other words, the relation between humans and the technologies they use are co-constitutive. Now, how is all the above relevant to the queer digital virtual visual archive? The digital archive contains pictures, photographs of painting and drawing, graffiti objects, stickers, pins, and so on. If you were to replace the text component in either a basic stream with photo, instead of iTech word, I will have iPhoto word. The technology here is the camera, the action is taking a picture, and it is executed by means of mechanical, chemical, and digital devices such as cameras. The outcome of the action is photographed, the object, an object which is a technological in and of itself. Let's linger on the action of taking picture for a moment and examine the hermeneutic relation taking place between the action and the object. In other words, reading and decoding the text, which is the photograph. Habitually, hermeneutic analysis of visual text tend to describe the world, or rather the way in which we experience the world. By interpreting the text, what we get in effect is only one layer. For instance, what image can we see? A woman, a tree, a mango. Who is this woman in the picture? Is she my mom? Is she my partner? But there are also embodiment relations, which constitute another layer. For example, can we learn something about the person who took the picture? A question such as this propels us to examine the composition and perhaps even the angle from which the picture was taken. This and other permanence would be read only through hermeneutic relation, not only through hermeneutic relation, but also in relation to the photographer. Where did he stand? What is her height? And maybe even what the gender assigned to this individual? This question will be discussed through embodiment relations. This kind of analysis does not focus on the action of taking a picture as such, rather the action as well as the technology remained in the background. What about the outcome of photography, the outcome of the act of taking a picture? The photograph is an object with a concrete presence. It is a photo object and stands as a technology in itself. When we take a picture, we perform an action that leaves traces in the world. Preservation of this photo object in the digital archives leaves a digital trace of an action which once occurred in reality. These long-forgotten actions become visible through the technology used to mediate them for us. Think of a newsletter, for example, or a riot, or whatever action in the world that happened, and the only thing we have to remember it is this photo object. I would like to recapitulate the main ideas so far. The post-phenomenological theory argues that first, there is no other way to experience and or study the world but through technological mediation, and the second, that the relation between humans and technology they use are co-constitutive. Given that, we must inquire about the structure of that experience. In what way does technology influence us in becoming subjects? Numerous scholars have addressed this question, referring to the expansion of the virtual sphere, to the flourishing of virtual communities, and more recently to the evolution of the social media. Theorists have written about the socializing dimension of the virtual sphere in establishing communities, exploring the impact that establishment on an alternative sphere has on constituent subjectivity and collective identity. I would like to generalize and argue the same for the visual materials in the archive as what enables us to establish queer subjectivity, community, and culture. Another question regarding the tech-human co-constitution may look for ways in which these photo objects motivate others to perform action in the world. The SREM, the post-phenomenological SREM is here. A possible answer of whether the object within the digital archive can motivate others to act is that materials in the queer archive are not just leftovers, evidence of finished actions. Rather, they are activated components, as Derrida claims, which echo our past, both constituting and revealing our queer reality. They are materials of valid cultural production, open-ended option for forming possible futures. We live in a digital world, and IDEA's post-phenomenologic emphasizes the co-constituent relation between I, technology, world. It offers us a toolkit for analyzing the digital traces, places in the queer archive as a potential, a platform for understanding, changing, taking action, and establish our queer reality right now and for reality may bring later on. And I want to finish and really, and I'm sorry for the excitement. The other initiative is, this is the some of the volunteers in the archive, the scanning some of the staff, feminist archive. And the other initiative that was mentioned here was the Arctic Israeli Queer Art. That is a new initiative I made 2 years ago, which is some kind of a step further from the archive to put it in the in everyday life. And since we started this initiative, we already had three exhibitions, art exhibitions, based partly on the archive materials. One is the first taken ever in a museum in Israel, which was in 2018, and the other one, and two others this year. I have just the invitation. Two others exhibitions, art exhibition, were taken in Israel. So I think the co-constitutive is not just between us and the technology. Is we need to mediate and to use these materials in real life, to bring them in life and to do things with it. So thank you very much.
How should we do this? Maybe come up here? I don't have to sit here. And we've got 20 minutes for discussion and questions. Where's Andre? Oh, okay. Do you want to sit down?
Yeah. Can you pass me the glass?
Water.
Yeah, thanks.
So, thank you, all of you. I want to open it up to everybody, but I thought first I'd like to give you four a chance to respond to each other. It seems to me that there's certain things in common with what you're talking about in terms of queer objects, but that there's also real differences in the archival situations in four different countries, four different situations. So I'm just wondering if any of you have questions or comments to each other about these similarities / differences.
So in terms of phenomenology, I was reading Sarah Ahmed and Queer Phenomenology, and I was just thinking about it in relation to the various formulas that you have listed. And
it's a bit of an anal, so I'm sorry.
No. It's a fantastic model because we can extrapolate upon it. And what I understand Sarah Ahmed to be doing is to put the plus and the divide and the minus and the times all together. So there's a disorientation of sorts. So the strategy is to disorientate all those multipliers in the formula that is given to us and try to reimagine how it can disorientate our relationship with technology and also the world. And in a way, that was the thing I was thinking about when I was thinking about the king who was lost in the fog.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do we deal with figures that are lost in the fog as queer archivists? How do we queer our relationship with them so that we do not surrender to the fact that they are lost to the fog forever and wait for them to come back and emerge?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do we go into the fog and, you know, just try to make things, just queer things, or even use the potential of fiction to queer out the materials that we have in our holdings, instead of this incessant desire to collect, to desire more? It's about limiting and working with the materials that we have and transforming them constantly. So our orientation towards them, phenomenology-wise, phenomenological relationship with these objects can constantly be questioned.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that what... what Andre was doing in his project is by giving others to write about the role models is to fiction, is to put themselves in the story and to tell the story from their point of view, instead of going to the archive and look where he was born, what he was eating for breakfast, and who his partner was. So this is a great thing. I just wrote it and I'll steal it for myself. And regarding phenomenology, it was a thought that I was reading a book, you know, and it made me think about what the relation that we, as I said, the archive I'm doing, the visual archive, I don't have money. It's like you were saying, it's in the apartment. I do it from my home. Just asking for people to send me photographs of the work or stuff they have, and I put it on the web, and not on the web right now, but they do folders and collect them. And there was a book I was reading, and I was trying to start to think how this material in the archive make me a queer subject. What it mean about me that I consume these materials? What can I do with them to become more lesbian, to become more queer, to be part of the community? What does it mean about the community? So the give and take of the I put materials over there and I take outside. So this is what I thought. But to my personal likeness, I prefer the Deleuze and Guattari, the Rhizome model. Not to have too much eye parentheses, but this and this and this and this. I want everything. So it was a thought.
I can comment on two things. The image of the king that got lost in the fog and never came back. Unfortunately, it's an image with it's 1550, I think, is from the 16th century. It defined my country and my people a lot. We are pessimists, we prefer to wait than to act. And this is terrible. We are like this. We are still waiting for the king to come back. And we prefer that instead of doing something. Regarding what was done in the project, it's what you said. I preferred not to have a biographical. At the end of the text, there is one line that says, this person was born in this city and used to be a writer. I don't say anything more, and I do the same for the people who wrote about him. And I did something a bit funny, if I'm allowed to use the word. I said, when I wrote my text, I wrote something like, I was born in Lisbon, I like pizza, and I like to read. This is my biography. It's not much more than this. The importance is, the focus is the stories that I was able, all these different voices. There are 50 texts, so there are about 50 people wrote about 50 people. So it's also an idea of a net, and it's also an idea of a virtual thing, because it was also very on Facebook and Instagram. But it became also, this was launched at our queer festival, so there was a kind of, they read their texts, so it was very nice to see another step that was like telling their oral history, although they had written the text, And so there's this idea of creating something that could spread. When I closed the project because it needed to be printed, and there were still people saying, I want to write about this, I want to do about this. One or two figures at 5-6 people that wanted to write. So it also increased the idea that there are different perspectives on the same person. And because we don't have anything written or noted down, it was best to have something that would be this multi-voiced instead of, I want to research his life and do a strip thing. And just another thing that I didn't mention before, and I think it's important, the people that we always think about as figures and personalities, they are not in this project. We have a very well-known poet that we always give as a reference as a gay man. There's another lesbian one. They don't exist on this project because everybody knows them. And also, if I may just to add, very interesting to notice that people that I thought no one liked them, there are 3 or 4 people saying, I really want to write about this because it was important, because of this little thing. And I thought this was very nice to follow during the whole project. Sorry, I didn't know if it answered something.
I just understand because I was really struck. I think you described your archive as an emotional archive. Mm-hmm. And as I was chatting about the dialogue project where elders and youth were asking each other questions, et cetera, and artists were responding, I was thinking that the artists who responded got to choose which oral history they were responding to. And I was really struck because I had kind of assumed people would sort of choose their same kind of person. They didn't. They were responding to these emotional chords. So it was just, that was really something that struck me. I'll also admit, as a history person, I like all the little details about people. I want to find out more about how,
What they eat,
what these 19th century, there are these 19th century lesbian diaries in Vermont that are just recently publicized that have details.
Yeah, so they wear underwears under the skirts.
No? Yeah, those kinds of questions are really interesting. Yeah. but the emotion, but using the term emotional archive, I thought was beautiful and definitely made me think of some of the projects I worked on.
It reminds me what you were telling before about your project, about the reacting to the materials. In a way, it reminds me of this project too. When you give the artist or people to stuff and ask them to react to the person, to the stuff, and to make the story, and it's connected to one of the lecture I heard in this conference that it was saying about the Stonewall riots, and it was saying how the narrative was changed through the years. Who started, why it started, when it started, and everything. And our narrative, because in the heteronormative archive, there's the compulsive narrative and unified narrative is a mandatory request. And in the queer archive, I think we obligate to make stories, to make our story, and from some kind of point, some other point of views, or not just one. It's I think this is clear. This is very clear.
I'll open it up.
So yes, we're taking all the
yes.
So maybe it's a comment or open question. I took from your presentations, and thank you of course for the presentation. And something that I feel related to, and this the idea and the need of touch. And I can tell like my own story as a young boy. I'm originally from Israel. I live in Berlin, but originally I heard about one of the first gay transvestite in Israel, Zalman Shoshi, and he was a bad word. Like my mother told me, you don't want to end like Zalman Shoshi. And the first thing I did, 2 days afterwards, I went to Bet Ariel, which is an archive for media and press and newspaper, and I checked who is Zalman Shoshi, and I remember the need of checking, there was not digital or anything, to touch the news, the paper. Mm-hmm. And then of course also to came out as gay, so I was pre-internet, so I went to the cruising area in Tel Aviv, which is Independence Garden, the name. And it's and I needed to touch first to understand myself. And I think today, with the digital world, it seems like we are going backwards in the sense that we don't need to go to a museum or to the archive to see the objects or to see or to get information. And I felt the need of that. And I think what you did, all of you, and definitely, the idea of the object that I feel really related to.
A digital watch, no less.
What? Sorry?
A digital watch, no less, that we can touch.
Yeah. And I think it's the next level. And I think it's, I think in general, as queer archives, we need, I think there is something about touching in our community, I don't know, it's not of being horny, but the idea of the idea, I think most of us, at least the one who came out before the digital time, we all understood ourselves if it's about gender or about sexuality from touching. I mean, for, you know, it's the third thing. So I think it's the next level or the next step of queer archive or queer art in general.
I guess you can also, I'm doing an archive at the moment of a different, he's gay, his work. And I think there's a certain responsibility with each image that you're doing that you should somehow offer whatever notations or backstory that you can. Because if the atmosphere isn't being invoked by the work itself, the backstory can add extra dimensions to that, which can be quite lengthy at times. So it's kind of to just disassociate an object and put it in space. If it's not contextualized and it doesn't emit a certain atmosphere, which makes tactility impossible, then it's sort of a backstory that accompanies the image can also invite the atmosphere of that march or that piece of cloth or that badge. Or
mm-hmm.
So it's kind of important, I think, also in digital archive.
Somebody had a hand up behind.
Yeah, thank you very much, Maria Spinoz. I really appreciate the discussion about emotions, affects, feelings, touching. My question is shockingly pragmatic, but I kind of, in reference to that discussion, I just wanted to bring up the name of Eve Sedgwick and her touching feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you think of from a queer perspective of these questions and getting to a different kind of epistemology, which is not an epistemology any longer, probably, I always liked that book. But my, as I said, shockingly pragmatic question is to Andre, because you said this is the beginning of something that might grow,
mm-hmm.
and then now you said that Portuguese people like to wait. I was just wondering what your, do you have any plans, kind of what might grow out of the project you've been presenting?
Well, I ended this part one of this volume one, so to say, and I didn't do anything else. This was launched last year. No one took no one took it from there. There's no one saying, okay, let's do something else. I'll try to sponsor a second book or anything. So they are waiting. If I do something, it will be very well received, I'm sure of that. But they are waiting. For now, I have other projects because I work in the theater. I'm a theater director. That's my main thing. So I, as much as I love this as I do, I cannot just focus on this. And also I have a boring job from 9 to 5, so there's a lot to do. So there's a lot to manage. But of course I will go back to this and I want to do something more with this and continue. There's a lot of people that didn't get in this. And we are also having a fashion right now, which is, there's a lot of people reviving people from the 20s. And we are rediscovering poets, the dancer that I didn't have the chance to talk. There's a play now about him because he spent 40 years after a lobotomy. And he used to dance with Nijinsky. And after that, he went to Lisbon and he got stuck in a bedroom after this operation. So there's a lot that we need still to talk. But if we don't do anything, it won't appear. So
It's a bit of a tricky question. I'm sorry. I don't have a quick answer for you.
Thanks a lot.
I can say from my side that I will try to continue something.
I just have a quick response to your comment on the tactility and the touch. One of the most radical things when I visited Elgar was that for the first time I went into an archive and I could touch the objects without having to wear gloves. And I think that's a phenomenon that is unique to a lot of queer community archives. And my worry is that as these queer community archives become part of institutions or institutionalized, then the gloves come in, the Ziploc comes in, the application and the permit comes in. And how would this transform the ability of people who would like to engage with the archive to really, you know, have that tactile, erotic, material relationship with it? Yeah.
I'd probably just say I'd still ask for nitrile gloves if you're doing photos, but I would also, this is more just a comment, if anybody hasn't seen Zihan's website, there's an amazing documentation of so many of his projects beyond the ones that he described, which are really fantastic projects to have a bit of a look at, and you can also see much more than the water, but dildo molds to everything that's sitting in the archives.
Yeah, because I come from a country where just to get into the state archive, you have to write a permit or have an application. And every step of the way is another kind of license or barricade. And just to be able to walk into Elgar and just pick up objects, that was something that really was the trigger for the entire body of work that I've been pursuing with this. Yeah. And about your comment on the backstory and the context, that's where storytelling and language comes in. But I would really, really argue that we have to be careful not to become the authority or not to be the one that is pronouncing that that is the person that threw the stone, that is the person that made this happen, and constantly encourage the reader to reconfigure their relationship to what they consider is factual and true. You know, to encourage a sense of criticality. So be duplicitous in the way we engage with how our material is being reproduced for an audience. I think that's necessary.
I think it's mandatory to do.
Yes?
I have a question, but it's actually not for one of the panelists, it's for Gerard. Is that okay?
No.
Because just this point that's raised, because you're part of an enormous archive now, or one that's certainly one of the biggest in the world. And I'm wondering, these recent comments about touch, access, license, could you comment about the state of your archive in relation to that? Because we've been hearing about the smaller scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly we started out at a very small scale with the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco. So we were founded in 1985.
Which is archival porn. I'm sorry, I've seen pictures.
Visit our website.
Don't.
In any case, we indeed started out as one of those small artisanal projects with 20 boxes in somebody's living room. And we've reached a scale now where, in fact, many of those measures that Jean described are in place simply because to be able to administer that size of collection and provide any kind of access to it requires certain forms of regulation. At the same time, we constantly are looking for ways to pierce that regulation, to have archival tours where people are brought back into the actual archival space where staff is only allowed normally, to bring out duplicates of materials where we have more than one copy and allow people to actually touch them and leaf through 1950s queer periodicals and so on. So there are ways in which it's inevitable that things become more structured and more regulated in order to be able to simply manage, preserve, and guarantee the collection is there and is available at all. But we're always looking for ways to queer that whenever we can and to welcome the kinds of critiques of the structure. So come visit us and tell us what we might do differently, better, more queerly. We love that.
I think that it is a struggle between preserving it and access to who has access to it and yet preserving it for the past. And I think that quite often is we as leaders of the queer archives of these collections do have to get together, do need to network about this, because it is important. There is an importance of till the haptic aspect of of an object, and yet also preserving them. And if we think as one, you know, as an archive, that we have the only, you know, the only sense of this, what if it is actually more widely available? Then the question of access becomes different and changed. And
right.
So we might have that that accessibility that we refrain from. So I think this is important. It's totally important.
Time for one more comment?
Yeah, I have a question for Z, but I'd be happy to hear what other people think about this too. So I'm thinking about the watch that you passed around, and the watch and the story, and you evoke Jane Bennett at the end, and I'm thinking about the ways that she traces objects really carefully about how their materiality has potentials and possibilities to have effects on our lives and in the world. I wonder what you think the materiality of the watch contributes, so the metal, the leather rubbing on skin, the feeling of it ticking is like a counterpoint to the heart beating. What lessons do you think we can learn from the watch as an object itself?
In the longer performance presentation, I do have a segment where I just analyze the screws, the human skin cells, the glass, and the fact that the strap is replaced. So it doesn't belong, it's anachronistic. It doesn't belong to this watch. And the layers and the surface and the tactility of it, I didn't have time to go into on this presentation. But yeah, in brief, the watch itself is queer because it has been torn into fragments and reassembled, and it's not even functioning. It's not telling time. It's stopping time. It's stopping time at 5 minutes, 20 seconds past 6 o'clock. Yeah.
It's right twice a day.
Yeah, it's right twice a day. Yeah. And that for me is, yeah, it doesn't take. It doesn't work anymore.
On a certain day, though.
Yes.
Because there's a date.
Yeah. Then it says Loon, yeah, which is Monday, I think, and the first.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
I think it's amazing with bringing up the fact that that watch can evoke another period, another take on another story, and discussing it. And I think it's like going back to that King in the Fog, and to think of Schrödinger's cat, that the king is alive and dead at the same time, and that to bringing these narratives in, it's so important in a queer archive, because both instances are valid mm-hmm. conclusions. And just I think what you were saying, you were had mentioned that we shouldn't have a definitive of this is what it is. Facts are changing constantly, stories are changing, and the experience of the archive, the experience of the exhibition, as soon as you say, you know, this is this, that's it, that's as far as it can go. You can't take it in, or the imagination of the experience can't go any further than saying exactly what it is. And a lot of the times, and we talked about this throughout this conference, is we definitively don't know. The smoking gun isn't always there, and especially in queer archives, to allow this possibility for every outcome is very important. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's what this conference does. It lets people, I mean, there's how to archive, and then there's how to bring that archive out to the public. And I feel like that's what we get at this conference, is new ideas. So thank you.